Any direction, if that helps, and then maybe later someone can reconnect the cables so that it's more convenient. Memory stick?
Yeah.
And then the file is Vrindavana Mahatmyam. That's the name of our text. Launches it from where it is, and we are going to start on verse 25, if you want to advance it. Maybe we can even get a wireless mouse for that. That would be nice. Make it more convenient. 25 will be the first verse. Very good. There we go. Good. Good. Shall we begin? Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejaswinavadhi Tamastu Mavidvishahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Oh, very good. Good. Recorders are turned on? Very good. Okay. Oh, no, if it's on, it's fine. Yeah, if you turned it on, then we're fine. Thank you. Good. So we finished in our previous class the prior chapter, chapter 74, Arjuna Anunaya, Arjuna's transformation. We spent three classes going through that chapter. Of course, it's more than 200 verses, so even three classes was a very abbreviated treatment, but it was enough to get the rasa of the story, which was really a very amazing story that culminated not merely with Arjuna's utter transformation. Utter transformation was he went from this mighty warrior called Mahabahu, he became Arjuni, a teenage girl, basically. And that was only half the story. The most amazing part is what the poet very delicately treated in one word. And that one word we said, reme, enjoyed. And enjoyed specifically in a sexual sense. Now, this is not meant to be lurid, but rather to understand the symbolism of that. We talked about half of symbolism in the last class. Let's pick up that thread, talk a little bit more about the symbolism. And we're going to find in the present chapter, which is Narada Anunaya, Naradji's transformation, we're going to find it ends up in the same place, even with the same word, reme. So it's worth understanding the symbolism properly. And just a brief comment here. It's amazing that it's uncomfortable in any Hindu religious gathering to even mention the subject matter. And what's significant is it apparently wasn't a problem in ancient times. Now, this shows something that many scholars feel was introduced into India by the Victorian British. That is, in ancient times, Hindus had a very pragmatic view of sexual actions. They were neither good nor bad. They were just part of life, like eating and sleeping. But then most of you know that Victorian values in England were extremely prudish, and anything even hinting at anything sexual is considered very inappropriate for civil company. This is certainly civil company. But many scholars feel that the British presence in India is what colored attitudes towards sex to the extreme. Any extreme. Both extremes are harmful, I think you'd agree. We don't need to say without any doubt, the extreme of promiscuity, free sexuality, is a horrible extreme. But perhaps we could say that the other extreme is also a problem, where we make sex a taboo thing that's never thought about or never talked about. So here it's talked about. And of course in a very appropriate way, and certainly a very delicate way, I'm smiling, oh yeah, I'm trying to remember how a typical Hindi movie treats that. It's usually the rain is falling or an ocean is going in and out. Something utterly unrelated, but usually having something to do with water. So this is the Bollywood portrayal of something which can't be portrayed. So here, the poet handles it very delicately, simply by reducing it to one word, a very meaningful word, to enjoy. Ram is a dhatu, reme is a perfect verb, perfect tense verb, past tense verb. It means enjoyed, past tense. And that's really all he says. And it clearly is a reference to this sexual enjoyment of Arjuna by Sri Krishna. Now, in the prior class, we said symbolically, this is the peak of experience. And the whole chapter, we said, was the emotional peak of the entire text. And that was the emotional peak of the chapter. And, you know, emotional peak for very obvious reasons. And the fact that the word climax is used both in literature and with regard to sex is no accident. Yeah, this is just matter of fact. This is poetry. So clearly it's the emotional peak, the emotional climax. And it was, there was a lot of lead up to it. And then after that, it wrapped up fairly rapidly. So, which is certainly a good metaphor. Okay. There's another part of the symbolism, however. Certainly the idea of emotional peak, emotional climax, is very clear. We've discussed that before. There's another aspect, and that is having to do with the degree of intimacy between two people, man and woman. Friends have closeness. Husband and wife have much more closeness. But husband and wife frequently aren't very close. We know that. But there are moments of intense closeness between husband and wife. And without doubt, the most complete moment of intimacy would take place during sex. It's human nature. Now, what makes that a moment of intense intimacy specifically is a condition of union that takes place at that point in time. Emotional union, physical union, and not only emotional and physical union, but in that experience, many people find that their sense of individuality, the ahankara, actually undergoes resolution briefly. It's almost like in forms of samadhi and forms of meditation, the ahankara goes away, where you no longer feel so inside your body. You no longer feel so much like a concrete individual. In sexual intimacy, many people experience what psychologists call an oceanic feeling, a feeling of boundaryless, a feeling of just being extremely expansive. And this is a feeling that commonly comes when the ahankara undergoes dissolution. It temporarily dissolves, as it does in forms of meditation. It's like a small samadhi. And we can say that it can take place in that moment. And the significance of that is astounding, I think. And that is, what is it that holds anyone back from complete union with Bhagavan? And it's ego, ahankara. And in meditation, you may have had opportunities where your own sense of self started to soften and started to dissolve. You may have found yourself giving way to this oceanic feeling. And you may have even felt in meditation a sense of merging with Bhagavan. Well, all of these feelings can and probably do frequently take place during sex. So what a perfect metaphor for union with Bhagavan. The same things take place. And that is, there is obviously physical closeness, physical union. That's the word we want to use here. And we're going to find a long passage on union in this text, in this chapter. There's physical union, there's emotional union, and then the final step is when the ego dissolves and all that holds you as an individual dissolves, falls away, and this is a condition of experiential absolute union. Of course, it may be brief, but it's there nonetheless. So, what better human experience to represent union with Bhagavan than that? So you can see the to introduce this into the text isn't, it has less to do with sex and has more to do with the poet seeking out some kind of human experience that can even begin to convey the ecstasy of losing one's sense of individuality and merging with Bhagavan. And delicately said in one word, Reme. Okay, that being said, we can move ahead to the next chapter, which is the the final of our transformation stories. We've been seeing one story after another after another. We had all these rishis in the prior chapter. They're all getting transformed into gopis. Arjuna, no less, is transformed into a gopi. And now in this present chapter, chapter 75, Narada undergoes transformation. And every chapter is quite different. We're also going to skip through this chapter. The chapter is over 50 verses, and we can't see all the verses. We won't try. What we're going to try to do is see the whole chapter in one evening. So we'll be skipping quite a bit so that we can get the essence, the rasa of this chapter. And we're going to start in the 25th verse in the second half, where there's a lot of story that precedes it, but the finally in the story, Narada approaches Brahmaji and is going to ask Brahmaji a question. And he asks in the second half of verse 25, Rahasyam varadhevesha vrindaranyasya me pitaha. Vara, please tell me, Devesha, O Lord of the gods, he addresses Brahmaji, Narada addresses Brahmaji, please tell me the rahasyam, the secret of Vrindavana. Please tell it, may, unto me, Pitaha, O Father of all, please tell me the secret of Vrindavana. And in the second half of 26, Tato Maha Mahavishnum Gacha Vatsa Prabhum Mama. This is Brahmaji's response to Narada, which is very interesting. Tataha, thereafter, Mam, unto me, Aha, he said, Brahmaji said. What did he say? Mahavishnum Gacha Vatsa. O dear one, go to Mahavishnu, who is Prabhum Mama, my Lord. Brahmaji is speaking here. Go to Lord Mahavishnu. Brahmaji here admits, I can't tell you the secret of Vrindavana. Go to Mahavishnu. And in the second half of 27, it yuktva mam grahitva cha gato vishnoscha dhamani. Iti uktva, having spoken thus to Narada, mam grahitva, Narada is speaking here, having taken me, gataha, he went, Vishnoho dhamani, to Lord Vishnu's realm, to his abode. So Brahmaji is taking, now, Narada, to meet Lord Vishnu. Mahavishnau cha katitam mayokta yattadevahi. And all of this was katita, as Narada had a chance to say all of this to Mahavishnu. And tat shrutva cha Mahavishnuhu svayambhuvam athadishata. Tat shrutva, Mahavishnu, having heard this request of Narada to experience Vrindavana, Mahavishnuhu Swayam, himself, no, Mahavishnuhu, he said to Swayam Bhuvam, to Brahmaji, he adishata, he gave instructions to Brahmaji. So what did he tell Brahmaji? Tvameva deshato mahyam nitva vai naradam munim snanaya viniyukshvamum sarasyamrita sanyake. He addresses Brahmaji and says, take Narada, Narad Muni, take him, nitva, lead him, adeshataha mahyam, according to my instructions, lead him and snanaya, make him bathe. Here we go again. Snanaya viniyukshva, be engaged in making him bathe, Where? Sarasi Amrita Sanyake, in a lake called Amrita. So one more bath, you can imagine what's going to happen. In the second half of verse 30, Tatra Amrita Sarashchaham Pravishya Snanamacharam. So, Tatra, going there to the lake called Amrita, Aham, I, nodded speaking, Pravishya, having entered that lake, Snanam Acharam, I bathed. Then, Tatkshana Tatsarah Pare Yoshitam Savidhe Bhavam. Tatkshanat, that very instant, as Narada goes into the lake. Tat saraha pare abhavam. Abhavam, I was, or I became, where? Tat saraha pare, on the other side of that lake. So he enters into the lake on one side, and instantly, he finds himself on the other side of the lake, Tatpare, and he finds himself Yoshitam Savidhe, in a group of girls. That is very strange. So suddenly transported to the other side of the lake, surrounded by these young women, and he further says, Sarva Lakshana Sampanna Yoshidrupati Vismita. He refers to himself as being Ati Vismita. He says, I was very surprised. Why? Yoshidrupa. Because I've acquired the form of a young woman. And Sarva Lakshana Sampanna, endowed with all beautiful attributes. So here, Narada is transformed. We'll see something interesting, just one more verse. Mam drishtva tha samayantim apracchamscha muhur muhuhu. Mam drishtva taha. Those young women, mam drishtva, seeing me, they were very curious. And so samayanti, they all surrounded me. They surrounded me and aprachan. They were asking. Muhu, muhuhur, muhur, muhuhu. Again and again, they were asking. What were they asking? Striya uva, striya uchuhu. Uchuhu is in the plural. They asked. And what did the women ask? Ka tvam kuta samhayata katayatma vicheshtitam. Obviously, ka tvam, who are you? Kutaha, where did you come from? Samayata, where did you come from? Kataya, please tell, atma vicheshtitam, tell, what are you doing? What are you doing here? So remember, she just appeared, Narada, in the form of this young woman, suddenly appears in this group of women. They're pretty surprised. Where did you come from? And Narada replies in the second half of verse 33, Kutah koham samayataha katam vayoshara kritihi svapnavatrishyate sarvam kim va mugdhosmi bhutale. So, kutaha, where I came from, and koham, kahaham, and who I am, samayataha, and where I've come from, katam, and how I came to be, va, yoshid akritihi, and how I came to acquire the form of a woman, swapnavat drishyate, it seems like a dream. It seems like a dream. Sarvam, all this seems like a dream. Kimva, or mugdaha asmi, or it seems like bhutale, here on this earth, I am somehow mugdha, somehow confused, or somehow in some kind of dreamlike state. So he's not sure what happened. What is clear, remember, there's an interesting difference between this story and Arjuna's transformation. Remember, when Arjuna was transformed, he had no memory of his prior form. Here, Narada, in transformed into as a young woman, is still referring to himself with masculine nouns. Mugdha asmi. You know, it's like if a woman were to say chalta hai, it doesn't sound right. So, but that's how Narada is speaking. He looks like a young woman, but he is very much identified with himself as Narad Muni, who has somehow acquired the form of this young woman. And now, of the ladies gathered there, there's one gopi named Lalita, and in verse 35, she is going to address Narada. Vrinda namni puri cheyam Krishna Chandra Priyasada. The place where you've arrived, this puri, this town, this place, iyam, this place is Vrinda namni. It's a place called Vrinda, and the forest is Vrindavana. Aham chalalita devi turya tita chanishkala. Aham cha, and I am Lalita Devi. She introduces herself, and I'm just going to skip ahead here to the second half of 36. And I'm going fairly quickly. It's just story, and I want to come to some very profound verses that come a little bit later. Mam pratyaha punar devi samagachamaya saha. Mam prati aha punaha devi. So then, Goddess Lalita said to me, what did she say? Samagacha, come with me. Samagacha maya saha, come with me. Anyasha yoshita sarvaha Krishna paraparayanaha. Tasha mam pravadantyevam samagachanaya saha. Remember, Lalita was one of this whole group of women. So now all, and they've all gathered around Narada, wondering, who are you? And so first Lalita says, come with me. And then all the women all together, they all say together, sarvaha yoshitaha, all of them together say, samagacha. All of them say, come with us. We're all going to meet Lord Krishna. Come with us. So all of the assembled gopis say that together. Tato nu Krishna Chandrasya Chaturdashacharo Manuhu Kripaya Katitastasya Devyaschapi Mahatmanaha. One more step, which will remind you of the earlier chapters when all the munis got transformed. Tataha, thereafter, Krishna Chandrasya Manuhu Chaturdashaksharaha. Manu here means a mantra of Sri Krishna. Sri Krishna Chandra. A mantra of Sri Krishna, which is Chaturdashakshara, of 14 syllables. And Kripaya, out of compassion, Katitaha, it was told to Narada. Tasya Deva Devyaha, by the goddesses who were Mahatmanah, who were very great, who were very holy. So notice there's still a mantra involved, there's still prayer involved. We've seen that even for Arjuna. Now Arjuna of course had to go from step to step to step to step, praying in this, doing these pujas, doing these vratas. Arjuna went through a very extended period of sadhana. Narada is apparently gets it much easier. He just gets this one 14-syllable mantra, and apparently that's all it takes. I guess that's why Narada is a Devarshi and Arjuna is a warrior, Kshatriya. So if you're a Kshatriya, it's going to take a little bit more work, I suppose, to get Krishna's darshan. But for a Devarshi like Narada, it comes very easily. So he's given, the gopis give him a 14-syllable mantra, and Tat kshanadeva tat samyam alabham vividhopamam upama. Tat kshanat, that instant. Tat kshanat eva tat samyam alabham. This is interesting. Alabham, I gained tat samyam, similarity to them, referring to the gopis who have led him. So he now, he was already appearing as a young woman. Now he appears exactly as these other gopis did. And appearance means in terms of dress, primarily. So they wear a certain kind of dress and their hair is arranged a certain way. So however the gopis appeared, now as a result of chanting the mantra, Narada's appearance changes to match that of the gopis. Tabhi sahagatastatra yatra krishna sanatanaha. And tabihi saha gataha. And she goes, Narada goes, along with the gopis. Where do they go? Yatra Krishnaha. Where's Sri Krishna? They go to Sri Krishna's abode. And then in the second half of 40, Yoshidananda hridayo drishtva mam prabhravin muhuhu. So having gone to Sri Krishna, then Sri Krishna here is described as Yoshidananda Hridaya, the one who makes the hearts of the gopis full of joy. So that one is Lord Krishna. Drishtva mam, having seen me, Narada says, abravit, he said, muhuhu, again and again, he said. So Krishna now addresses Narada. Samagaccha prihe kante bhaktya mam parirambhaya. Excuse me. So Krishna now says, samagaccha, please come. Come, priye, O dear one, kante, O beautiful one, please come, and bhaktya, with devotion, mam, me, Sri Krishna speaks, mam parirambhaya. Parirambhana is embracing. Parirambhaya, it's a command. Embrace me with devotion. And the poet just, it makes it very clear. And it's a prelude to what comes next. And what is the next word? Reme. So, Sri Krishna, Reme, enjoyed. Enjoyed Narada in the form of the gopi. And enjoyed for, this is cute, Varsha Pramanena, for 1 year. So Arjuna had it very briefly, apparently, we don't know. But Narada, for 1 year, is enjoyed, Reme is enjoyed by Sri Krishna. So here we come to exactly the same word. So please reflect on the symbolism, and I'd encourage you, I know a lot of people have misinterpreted tantrika teachings, and I know a lot of crude things have gone on in the name of religion and in the name of humanity. We all know that. But in this text, what is being described is very simple, it's very pure, it's very holy. There's absolutely nothing untoward about anything we're seeing here. And it, here again, uses sexual union as a metaphor. Now remember, all of these transformation stories were to represent our own individual processes of transformation. So our transformations then are meant to culminate in union. Let me just say the word, in an experience of oneness and an experience of non-separation. That experience of non-separation comes when we, in prayer and meditation, when we are able to drop our sense of being who we are as individuals. This fading of the ego, ahankara, is something we need to speak about it again a little bit briefly. It happens in many situations. The example I've given in many classes is when you're listening to your favorite music and you get so caught up in your music that you feel like you're getting lost in the music. That's an interesting experience, getting lost in the music. When you get lost in the music, you still hear the music, don't you? Therefore, who gets lost? That's exactly the experience I'm talking about. That is resolution of the ego. That the ego dissolves. Music is, I am not. The prior moment, I enjoy this music. In that state of absorption, I don't exist. Only the music is. Therefore, in that state of absorption, you can't say or think, I enjoy the music. There's only music and enjoyment. There's no I. It's as though the distance between I and music gets closer and closer and closer until finally there's no distance whatsoever between I and music. You're lost in the music. Certainly, this can and does take place during sex, and that's why the reference is here. So that sense of blissful union between husband and wife, between man and woman, is what's said here. So in terms of our sadhana, the goal then is in prayer and meditation to come closer and closer and closer until finally that distance disappears and you feel yourself lost and absorbed. That's the goal. That's what these upasanas are about. This whole text is a text on upasana, devotional meditation, and this is the goal of these upasanas. Prayer and meditation, all the symbolism, all the stories are meant to evoke emotions. Emotions draw us closer. Some of you remember 2 years ago when you were taking Narada Bhakti Sutras, we said emotions draw us close. It's that power of drawing closer and closer, more intimacy, more intimacy, more intimacy. So all that has come before this in the text, all the stories, all the imagery, all the beautiful descriptions are all meant to draw us closer and closer and closer and closer until in deep meditation we can let go of that sense of individuality, drop any remaining barriers, and just enter into a state of non-separation, an experience of unity. And that's what exactly what is described here. All right. Now, I want to come to this interesting passage. It actually begins a few verses later, verse 44, where Sri Krishna now is speaking. This is apparently after the 1 year of enjoyment has come to an end. And now Sri Krishna is going to describe this state of oneness. And he's going to describe it in some very interesting words. So this is how Sri Krishna describes a condition of union. He's not describing the state of union. He is describing why such a union exists. He is giving the philosophy or the mechanism underlying this experience of union in verse 44. Aham chalalita devi radhika ya cha giyate. Aham cha lalita devi. Sri Krishna is speaking here, and he says, I am Lalita Devi. Not just Lalita, Radhika cha. And I'm Radhika also. Ahancha Vasudeva kyaha Nityam kama kalatmakaha. And of course, aham, cha, and also I am Vasudeva, Akya, the one who is called Vasudeva, the one who is called the son of Vasudev. Satyam yoshit swarupoham, yoshit chaham sanatani. Satyam, in truth, yoshit swarupaha aham. I am the essence of these. Yoshit here is young woman, means the gopis. I am the essence of the gopis. Yoshit cha aham sanatani. I am the eternal. Yoshit sanatani. I am the eternal woman, Sri Krishna says. So he's talking about his existence as the one within us all. So the idea being the union we experience is not to go out and find Sri Krishna out there. Of course, Arjuna found Sri Krishna out there in Nitya Vrindavana. Narada also goes to Nitya Vrindavana and finds Sri Krishna out there. We are also going to find Sri Krishna in Nitya Vrindavana, but Nitya Vrindavana is not out there, as we've described before. Nitya Vrindavana is in our own minds and our own hearts. So, within our own hearts, since Narada says, I am the Sanatani Yoshit, I am the eternal woman, I am Lalita, I am all this, I am the one in all, one who abides in all. Aham cha Lalita Devi Pum Rupa Krishna Vigraha. I am the... This is interesting. Lalita Devi Pum Rupa. I am... I don't know how to translate this. The genders are so interesting. Pum Rupa means in the form of a male, but it's got a feminine ending. So it's grammatically, it's very odd. Pum Rupa, I am the maleness in Lalita Devi. For he says first, I am Lalita Devi. I am the maleness in Lalita Devi. Krishna Vigraha, I am Sri Krishna who dwells in Lalita Devi as Krishna. And he concludes then, and here's a very important verse. Avayor hantaram nasti satyam satyam hi Narada. And this is really the bottom line here. Narada, satyam satyam. This is the truth. Indeed, this is the truth. What is the truth? Avayoho, between the two of us, antaram nasti. There is no separation. There is no difference between the two of us. So, Sri Krishna is already here. And this is very Vedantic also. We said in Vedanta, you don't become Satchidananda Atma. You already are Satchidananda Atma. So in the language of bhakti, Sri Krishna is already here. But we fail to experience that sense of union with Sri Krishna's presence within because of our ignorance, because our minds are elsewhere, because of our egos. So in this form of upasana, devotional meditation, attention is turned within to the Nitya Vrindavana, which is in our own minds and hearts. And since Sri Krishna dwells within in that Nitya Vrindavana, then one has an opportunity for that sense of merging and union, turning one's attention within. All right. And then the chapter ends fairly rapidly. We'll just skip ahead to verse 48, the second half. Tato nu Radhika Devi mamnitva tat sarovare. Tataha, thereafter, Radhika Devi, Radha, mamnitva, Narada says, she led me. Where did she lead me? Tat sarovare. She led me to that great lake. And in verse 49, Tato nimanjana deva narado hamupagataha vinahasto ghanaparaha tadrahasyam muhurmuda. Tataha. So after bathing in that lake, then what? Tataha nimanjanat. There, after bathing in the lake, eva indeed, narada aham upagataha. I became Narada once again. Aham narada upagat. I regained myself as Narada. And what narada? Vina hasta. So he's got it. Apparently he lost it for a while. So immediately as he returns to his prior form, then he has his vina back in his hands, and he is gana paraha. He's also fond of singing and chanting. And tadrahasi mahur muda, and he's delighted by this great secret that he has experienced due to the blessings of Mahavishnu. So here again, the transformation, he goes back. I suppose that represents the conclusion of meditation. Notice the transformations. Actually, let's reflect on this for a moment. The transformation of Arjuna and of Narad Muni both ended with, after being enjoyed by Sri Krishna, they both returned to their prior forms. In fact, remember at the end of the prior chapter, Arjuna was really depressed after returning to his prior form. And then Sri Krishna had to console him and cheer him up, which he did. Seems like Sri Krishna is always cheering up Arjuna. he did a lot of that in Bhagavad Gita, and now even here in Padma Purana, Sri Krishna is having to cheer up Arjuna. Meditations come to an end. And what we're describing here is an experiential union. Let's talk about this. This is a little bit Vedantic, but it's worth talking about. An experience of union. Those of you who have heard Pujya Swami Dayananda, my guru, speak, you know that he never describes moksha in terms of experience of union, for good reason. This is not moksha. This is not enlightenment. This experience of union is an experience. An experience gained, in the case of Arjuna and Narada, an experience gained as a result of tremendous prayer and tremendous blessings. And in the case of you and I, an experience of union that can take place due to devotion to your sadhana, devotion to Bhagavan. And when your sadhana, when your meditation grows and becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, you can have this kind of experience of union. It's not rare. If you want it, it's accessible for anyone who wants it. You work at it, you have the proper instruction, and you do the sadhana, it is indeed accessible. An experience of union is accessible. But notice, it's an experience. And one thing that's true about any and every experience, all experiences come to an end. Experience goes on changing. That's the nature of experience, is it not? Whatever is your experience today, it'll come to an end in several hours when you go to bed and sleep. The experience of today will be over, and the experience of tomorrow will be different. And even in the course of a day, your experience goes on changing. Even in the course of this class, from the beginning to the middle to the end. It's close. Even in this moment of experience is different from this moment of experience. Experience changes every moment. Sri Shankaracharya says, kshana bhangara. Every moment, experience is being destroyed. Every moment, the prior experience is destroyed as a new experience emerges. This is the nature of experience. This text is about devotional meditations, which culminate in this experience of union. And since it is experience, it's transient. It comes to an end. Does it mean it's worthless? Hardly. We can say for several reasons. Any ecstatic experience is usually brief. When you get lost in the music, how long are you lost in the music? Hours? Minutes? If that, more likely, seconds. Seconds, minutes if you're lucky. Hours? I don't know, maybe if you're a great musician or a great sadhaka, but generally not. Momentarily. And to go back to our sexual metaphor, in sex, it's also momentary, brief. Any experience of bliss is brief. And there's a good reason for that. Suppose it were to last for hours and hours and hours. Imagine a state of ecstasy lasting days and weeks and months and years. Would you experience it as a state of ecstasy if it went on and on and on and on and on? You'd think it's normal. It's just like when you have a nice day after many rainy ones, how glorious it is. But if you live in a place where it's always nice, then it's no big deal. I remember when I lived in Santa Barbara, California, everyone was fond of saying there, another crummy day in paradise. They didn't use the word crummy, but I'll leave that word out. Another crummy day in paradise is the term they used, because the sun shines like 300 days a year in Santa Barbara, California. It's one of the sunniest places. So another crummy day. You get used to it. So one of the reasons that an ecstatic experience is ecstatic is precisely that it's momentary, it's brief. The beauty of it, the value of it, is precisely in its brevity. There's a famous example that poets love to use. In fact, Tagore also loves this particular metaphor. Why is it that we treasure flowers so much? Yeah, sure, they're colorful, and yeah, but many things are colorful. One of the things that makes flowers so treasured by us and so enjoyed by us is they don't last very long. They bloom. They're around for a while, you know, days or so, and then gone. So you have to be there at the right time and the right place to enjoy that beautiful flower. Otherwise, it's gone. So the beauty, the experience of beauty, is enhanced by the brevity of the experience. It makes us treasure that experience more. You know, a contrast. You know, I guess the What is the experience? You have to say in Hindi, Kagas pul? Is that it? Kagas kapul. Right. Oh, is that also a movie? I don't know the movie. Okay, it's a movie, I don't know. But think about it, you know, paper flowers. Yeah, okay. The paper flowers can be just as colorful as the real ones. In fact, you can make them even more colorful. You can have all rainbow colors. You can have a paper flower more brilliant and more complicated than any real flower. But given the choice between that paper flower and an ordinary but real flower, which will you choose? Obviously. What is the difference? That real flower is fragile. It can only be enjoyed for a few moments, for a few days, so it's something to be treasured. Ecstatic experiences are like that. The experience of being lost in music, the experiences in sex, and here, the experience of meditative union, devotional union in meditation, this form of vipassana. It's not moksha. It's not meant to be moksha. It is, however, a state of intense blessing to find yourself, in terms of your experience, utterly non-separate from Bhagavan. It is its own reward. If I ask you, why do you like flowers? Yeah, what do you mean, why? You're just flowers? You just like? In the same way, if you ask, why should one seek meditative experience of union? It's its own value. It's not a matter of why. It's like enjoying that beautiful flower. So this text is like a manual for gaining that state of union, that experience of union. If you wonder how does this fit into sadhana in general, you can imagine that this, and to put a Vedantic spin on this, in Vedanta, we understand that experiences are transient, so this experience of union can't be the goal. The goal of moksha is to discover that you are always non-separate, and even in the presence of your mind, even in the presence of your ego, you are non-separate from Brahman. But in order to discover that fact with sufficient clarity that all ignorance is destroyed, in order to destroy all that ignorance, in order to gain that kind of clarity, it's extraordinary and requires an extraordinary degree of blessing. And certainly this kind of meditation is capable of purifying your mind and heart, blessing you in all the ways that are necessary for Vedantic wisdom to really go in all the way and lead you to moksha. So just to make clear, don't get confused, this state of experiential union with Sri Krishna is not moksha. On the other hand, this kind of meditation, perhaps as much or more than any other kind of sadhana, can prepare you for the ultimate goal of Vedanta. It's very, very, very powerful. Good. So that concludes our present chapter, and that's also the last chapter of a series of chapters on transformation. So we'll see. We're going to have a change of subject matter with our next chapter. Also, as we proceed, there are a few chapters we're going to skip over because they're, when we come to them, I'll explain why. The next chapter, for example, is very odd. The next chapter is in prose. All of this has been in verse form. Next chapter is in prose. It's also written very awkwardly, and it's also extremely short, about 20 lines, maybe 15 lines. How? Go figure. And when you read it, when I read it, it doesn't look like it's the same author. It looks like it got stuck inside there. Remember, we're studying these ancient texts. These ancient texts get compiled, and how they get compiled, no one knows. I have this funny image. Of course, mostly it was through an oral tradition, but by the time this Padma Purana was being compiled, I suppose a lot of writing was going on. all the writing on palm leaves. I have this funny image to explain some of our texts. I can imagine two sadhus, each with their palm leaf manuscripts, and they're reading their palm leaf manuscripts, and they're a little careless, so that tantra, the string, has come loose. And these two sadhus are reading their books, and they're walking along. You know, I don't know, people read and walk. Sometimes they read and walk. And they bump into each other, and they both drop their books. And all the leaves get scattered. And now they have to put them back. But there are no page numbers, right? And so I imagine they're trying to reassemble their palm leaf manuscripts, and things get a little jumbled, a little out of order. Anything happens. So apparently in this Padma Purana, a few weird things have happened. So the next chapter looks like what scholars call an interpolation. Interpolation means something that got inserted that probably wasn't part of the original text. There are also several chapters that are very detailed about certain kind of Vaishnava ritual. There's a chapter and a half describing Shalagram Shilas. A chapter and a half talking about the markings on these stones. And does that seem consistent with what we've been studying thus far? So that would also seem like what scholars would call an interpolation, somebody else's work, which was put incorporated into this present text. So we'll probably skip some of the material that's not focused on devotional meditation. Our reason for taking up this text is upasana, devotional meditation. So we'll skip around in some of the chapters. We still have several chapters left to see. So shall we prepare ourselves for some meditation? Amritamgamaya Om Shanti 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 Om Tat Sat.
Before you
leave, have a happy announcement. For a long time, we've wanted to